Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. The solar wind tonight, 460 kilometers per second, and the sun is blank with no sunspots. And the proton count is very low, only 1.9 protons per cubic centimeter. On Wednesday morning, April 22nd, the planet Venus will disappear behind the moon. During the peak of the Lyrid meteor shower, should be quite a show. You don't want to miss it. After a billion-ton cloud of hot magnetized gas has just left the sun, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, SOHO, recorded the explosion at the end of the day on April 17th. That was 2 days ago. But we're lucky here on Earth this time. It is going another direction. The bright coronal mass ejection is not heading for Earth, so there will be no geomagnetic effects from the explosion. But it does remind us that sunspots are not required for solar activity. The source of the blast appears to be an erupting prominence high above the sun's northeastern limb. And NASA's Kepler mission has taken its first images of the star-rich sky, where it will soon begin hunting for planets like Earth. The new first light images show the mission's target patch of sky, a vast starry field in the Cygnus Lyra region of our Milky Way galaxy. One image shows millions of stars in Kepler's full field of view, while two others zoom in on portions of the larger region. One new image from Kepler shows its entire field of view, a 100-square-degree portion of the sky, equivalent to two side-by-side dips of the Big Dipper. The regions contain an estimated 14 million stars, more than 100,000 of which were selected as ideal candidates for planet hunting. And if you have children in college, then you are buying a lot of textbooks. I do. I have two kids in college, and they eat their weight in textbooks, and they cost a lot of money until now. I want you to check out Campus Book Rentals and discover the newest and least expensive way to get those textbooks for those college kids. You rent them. Amazing, huh? I think it is a fantastic way to make a great college education available to everyone. So click on the Campus Book Rentals banner at X Squared Radio and reduce the cost of higher education. We often talk about preparedness here at X Squared Radio. That is why we have NitroPack as one of our favorite affiliates. They have everything from 72-hour kits to full food storage packages. Don't get stuck with a 55-gallon drum of wheat. You can't haul it anywhere if you have to move. You have time to plan, so make survival the least of your worries by visiting NitroPack today and get prepared. I own an inkjet printer. I suspect you own a couple as well. How about getting the lowest cost of inkjet supplies, free shipping, and a chance to win a free printer each time you buy? Sounds good, doesn't it? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio and discover how easy it is to stock your office or home with the best for less. Last week here on X Squared Radio was Easter Sunday. We had a special message that might help you throughout the rest of the year. If you missed it, you can go back to the archives at X Squared Radio. Or if you're listening to us on Conscious Media Network, you can usually catch the last week's archive on ConsciousMediaNetwork.com, or you can go to BBSRadio.com. We are proud members now, 4 years of BBS Radio Network, one of the largest webcast radio networks in the world. And if you're listening to us through BBS Radio and you think you have what it takes to be a talk radio host, you've got something to say, get a hold of Don down at BBS Radio and see about becoming a host of your own program. This week, we have a most special and rare program for you. Many of you don't know where it started or how we came to imagine what we think about the year 2012. The date is synonymous with awakening and cataclysm and with an entire movement of consciousness. By the time this program is over tonight, you will know where it started and who started it. We often take the origins for granted, but X Squared Radio is where the past meets the future. It is exceedingly rare to have the past actually come to life. The book is called 2012, Biography of a Time Traveler. The author is Stephanie South, who is here with us tonight. But what is even more rare and special is that the subject of the book is none other than Jose Arguelles, and he too is here with us tonight. Welcome to the program, Stephanie. Did we lose Stephanie? It's a possibility. We have wonderful occurrences here on the world of webcast radio. Happens all the time. And it's all right. We'll get her back on the phone pronto. Not a problem. The book is published by New Page Books. And I got to tell you, when it was made available to me, the publicist told me that Jose Arguelles really doesn't do interviews. And, you know, would it be possible to interview Stephanie about her book, 2012, Biography of Time Traveler? And I said, are you kidding? Of course, we'll make room. And through her graciousness, and I have to tell you, through Jose's incredible magnanimous spirit, he has agreed to come on the program tonight. So that is how we contacted them, and hopefully we'll get them back on in just a moment. As we were going through our sound checks tonight, the subject matter of this book is so profound. I just can't tell you what a great privilege it is to have the book. And I can't recommend it more highly to you. If you're a studier, a student of the subject of 2012 and the phenomenon and how it got started, who thought of it first, where did this incredibly eclectic and enlightened view of this page of humanity that is about to turn come from? It came from this man. And that is what we're going to discuss tonight. While we're waiting, I did want to tell you that last week we spent the week in Kentucky, where I'm coming to you tonight from. Deep beneath the earth here in western Kentucky, a little town called Madisonville. Has quite a bit of history behind it. Early settlers of the United States came here. The interesting thing is that we brought our electric car out here. The company manufactured it in 1994 from a 1994 Geo Metro. All the gasoline parts were taken out and refitted with our electric parts. All went well until 1998, when Detroit attorneys succeeded in defeating the mandates that require 10% of the commuter fleet of the state of California to be electric. And the market for electric cars dried up. You'll remember gasoline was about 95 cents a gallon. Nobody was really interested in electric vehicles except for certain visionaries in California who created the mandates in the first place. So the electric car was effectively killed. And General Motors did everybody a favor by gathering up their EV1s and crushing them because, frankly, had they been put out to the general public, it would have ruined the industry of electric cars for at least 30 years. So recently, however, we went through a rather painful hike in gas prices, and even more painful emotional process as we struggled with the idea that there's no darn good reason why gas prices should be that high. And many Americans felt that they just did not want to be put in that position again. So the market for electric cars reemerged. And so did Global Green Cars, which is the original full production electric vehicle in the United States in the early 90s. They produced several hundred cars and Ford Ranger trucks, which are still on the road today, and they still enjoy a great performance, very top performing. In fact, the GO is a world record holding a speed record for Pikes Peak Hill Climb. It also holds the record for the longest distance on a charge. And although the company has not been inactive, transferring over to biodiesel and alternative fuels and being very successful there as well, seventh largest producer of biodiesel in the country, largest producer on the West Coast for many years. The shareholders January 2009 shareholders meeting clamored to the front, "We want you to bring out the electric car again." And so that's what we did. We took out the original 1994 Geo. It's got about 5,000 miles on it. Put a fresh coat of paint on it, new tires. Went through Utah, where it was covered on KSL TV a couple of weeks ago. This week we've been in the state of Kentucky with it. Thursday morning at 10 o'clock, I sat down with Governor Steve Beshear of Kentucky and outlined our plan for introducing a manufacturing facility into eastern Kentucky should their state incentives come through. And all was received well. The car performed well around the racetrack and still going strong. I can tell you that the rumors that electric vehicles are weak and don't perform well and don't last has been laid to rest forever. The electric motors in the Global Green Cars vehicles will last for 50 years. And if they ever go bad for any reason whatsoever, some kind of short circuit or open or whatever, it's the easiest thing in the world to have fixed. You simply take the electric motor to any rewinding shop anywhere in the world, and for around $100 or $200, they just rewind the motor, put it back in the car, and you're good to go for another couple of decades. Much, much more reliable and much more robust than any gasoline engine ever thought about being. But the beauty is that the car takes no fuel. You just plug it into an ordinary 110-volt wall socket and charge it up, and you can drive it again the next day. The car with just regular lead-acid batteries goes about 60 or 70 miles on a charge, which is way further than most commuters go to work. However, since 1994, the DOT has gotten heavily involved in the safety aspects of the automobile. And although this car was crash-tested in 1995, a model just like it, by our company, and it passed, they don't make 1994 Geo Metros anymore. So now what we are doing is introducing a new pickup truck. It'll be two-wheel drive and four-wheel drive, two-seater with an extended cab, a variety of bed options. And in order to facilitate sales and begin immediate revenue functions for the company, they're going to introduce a delivery vehicle, a commercial vehicle, fleet vehicle that can be used for cities and towns, airports, hospitals, mines, all kinds of organizations that on a commercial basis with commercial license plates use small pickup trucks. Now, the beauty of the small pickup truck is It can go to remote areas where there is just electricity and do just fine. The beauty is it can be used where in areas where no pollution is allowed. And, in areas like mines, or if you're keeping a vehicle on an airport or hospital grounds or university grounds, and you need something that's reliable that you can plug in from time to time, maybe a couple times a day, just keep it charged up like you would warm up your radiator in the north states of this country. It's completely convenient and far more torquey and powerful than the gasoline engines are, and non-polluting. And the prices look like they're going to come out somewhere around $20,000 to $25,000 for a base model, completely affordable. And as synergy would have it, the same day that the plug-in electric car arrived in Kentucky, a company called NatBat, which is a company that has been formed of a consortium of companies to produce none other than lithium-ion batteries, announced that it's opening a plant less than 2 hours away from the site of the proposed manufacturing plant. Now, how is that for synergy? What you have is a supplier announcing the very same day that the manufacturer announces that it's going to go into business. Now, that is real synergy. Unbelievable how that fits together. You know, nothing fits in an electric car like an electric battery. And it's one thing to develop an electric battery and have no cars to put it in, and quite another to have 30 or 40,000 cars a year coming off of an assembly line, which the public is scooping up as fast as they can make a 110-volt wall socket available to draw the demand of those batteries out of your plant. So it's perfect synergy. Looks like there's hope for the planet after all. So right now we're not having any luck getting Stephanie South and Jose Arguelles back on the phone. We'll keep trying. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is a 3-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, be sure to get back with us. Let us know at info@x2-radio.com, and we'll get a hold of that affiliate and get that fixed for you. X Squared Radio has been around for about 4 years, and we came up with the name as a way to express a mathematical function that every number put into that function comes out positive. So this program is designed to always be positive. We don't attack anybody. We don't do conspiracy theories or ghosts or all that kind of stuff. We just want to talk about the great science and great things that are happening out there to perhaps change the karma of the planet through scientific means. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate you, the listener, coming to us weekly to listen to this program. It is because of you that we have been here for 4 years. And we appreciate any mail, any phone calls that you want to send to us. And by the way, if you want to call, I will give you the call-in numbers right now. You can call in toll-free anywhere on the planet, or off-planet, for that matter. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. That number is, hold on 1 second while I pull it up here. Well, we're just having a good time tonight. I'm not able to find the number. Hang on 1 second here. Let me go to my other trusty source, which is the non-rebootable notepad, which has all of the numbers on it, and I don't have to worry about booting it back up. The number is 888-228-4494, anywhere toll-free on the planet. And if you've got free nights and weekends on whatever cellular plan you enjoy, you can reach us directly at 530-776-5144 or 5154 and give us a call. So right now we are trying to get them back on the radio. It shouldn't be but just a couple seconds. We're working on it. That's one of the reasons why we love live radio, because you never know what's going to happen, and you just roll with it. So now you have the phone numbers, and now you can call us up, and we're going to be going over the book, 2012, Biography of a Time Traveler. It's going to be very interesting. The biographer's name is Stephanie South. And, you know, being a biographer is a little bit like being a journalist, but Stephanie South is a former journalist and co-author of the 7-volume Cosmic History Chronicles, of which the first four books of the first four, Book of the Throne, Book of the Avatar, Book of the Mystery, and Book of the Initiation have been published. She is currently working on the 5th volume, Book of the Time Space. She met Arguelles in 1998 after a series of dreams in which he demonstrated time travel and telepathy. She is currently working with him on the Noosphere 2 project, on the an investigator into the nature of time and cosmic states of consciousness. So Stephanie's well-versed, well-qualified. It's room 524. And fortunately, all of this time travel, all of this study is being brought to bear right now on X Squared Radio. And about now is when our channels are full. That is, in the world of webcast, the radio program goes out over the web and people tune in from all over the world, and it begins consuming bandwidth. And although the bandwidth is virtually unlimited, we can see how many people are tuning in. So it takes about 10 or 15 minutes after X Squared Radio starts that our record-holding audience, live audience, comes on. So welcome aboard, everyone. And we're about to begin with Stephanie South, who is going to come on for a few moments, a few minutes, and then we're going to transfer over to Jose Arguelles. I hope that you realize what a special treat this is, because Jose doesn't normally do interviews. It's a rare privilege to have Stephanie on the line. Stephanie, are you back with us?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. A little bit of a cyberspheric breakdown there.
Well, yeah, in live webcast radio, you never know what's going to happen. It's not like we have a team of expert engineers with fiber optic cable going directly to a satellite 23,500 miles out into space.
Right.
And spending like $1 million all the time. So we roll with it here. And actually, our listeners like it, because it's sort of like, you know, the Carol Burnett show sometimes. You never know what's going to happen, and people
right,
just laugh
exactly.
And roll with it. I have to be honest with you, Stephanie. I've never actually interviewed a biographer before, and your approach to this book was not like any journalist I've ever read. You made a connection with Jose. How did you come to know him?
Well, I came to know him. It's quite an unusual... under quite unusual circumstances. I met him at the 1998 Whole Earth Festival. It was the 28th annual Whole Earth Festival that he had begun 28 years earlier. And my partner at the time was a man named Paul Levy. And now Paul was the head of the Padmasambhava Tibetan Center in Portland, Oregon. And Paul had a dream, that he needed to go to this Whole Earth Festival to actually honor Jose as being a tertön, which in the Tibetan tradition means hidden treasure finder. So my meeting with Jose, everything that's happened has completely been through the dream and through synchronicity.
Wow, that's amazing. That's even more strange than webcast radio, because...
Yeah.
And you know, lots of people think, gee, that's really unreliable, but it's been reliable enough to produce this work.
Yes, it's been an incredible journey. This work began in 2002, so it's been 7 years.
Wow.
And as you can probably read, or since you've read the story, you can see it was much more. It's much more than a biography. It's actually, as I was doing it, and as the more conversations that I had with Jose, who you'll talk to here in just a few moments, the more that I saw that this was actually some type of a higher dimensional template that was weaving through the story. It's a template of synchronicity that begins right away, and I could really feel that throughout the whole story, and it was definitely a completely transformative experience working with Jose on his life.
Well, you do a great job putting it into words, too. It's one thing to sit there and be dictated a story. It's another
right.
to, you know, take 7 years of all kinds of snippets and archives and put it in some kind of chronological order and then deliver a message with it. And now the book's about 305 pages long, but I get the feeling it could easily have been 500.
It was to begin with. I had to cut it back a lot. And there's actually a second volume. This only goes up until 1993. So there's a whole second volume that's ready to publish probably in 2010.
Awesome. Well, if tonight goes well, and I suspect it will, I want to be first in line for that interview as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say one more thing, and then I'm going to put Jose onto the phone. I just wanted to set him up just a little bit, you know, and I'm sure that you'll talk to him about this, but just so he doesn't have to repeat certain things. You know, the 2012 phenomena, like you said, is just exploding exponentially everywhere. It seems every day somebody's commissioned to write a new 2012 novel or book, and it is really important, and Jose will tell the story of how, you know, of how it came to be, but I just want to say in working with Jose and you know, in working with him, that he absolutely embodies or lives this entire, everything that he writes and talks about, this frequency, and his whole life has been pivoted toward this 2012 date, and this biography was really meant to be to really, really show how a visionary or a planetary artist and a visionary, how difficult it is to be a visionary or bring through new knowledge or information to this planet in this human realm that is completely, you know, judgmental or negative or isn't, or wants conformity or isn't used to new knowledge. And so I think that's the main emphasis or the main theme of the story, is just showing the difficult human struggles of a visionary trying to bring through this new information and all the challenges that he came up against in his third dimensional body. So that being said...
All right, there's our countdown. Yeah, interesting night. The studio just got struck by lightning, so we were knocked off the air. Are you there? Are you there? The studio just got struck by lightning. That's what knocked us off the air.
Is that really? Lightning?
Yeah.
Wow. What a wild night.
I'm telling you, in 4 years that we've been on here, we've never been struck by lightning. That was really cool. Good thing.
Wow,
I had my
heat. Hey, that's a great sign.
That's very auspicious, isn't it?
Very auspicious. So at what point did we get cut off?
You were explaining about how difficult it was for a visionary in this
right.
world of negativity and closed-mindedness to actually make inroads and be brave enough to weather
exactly.
you know, the disappointment and rejection of society, and that's when lightning hit. I thought, oh
yeah,
that's
wow.
that's really cool.
That's a good exclamation point. Maybe I should pass the phone on over to Mr. Arguez.
That's perfect.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Perfect cue. Okay. Okay.
Right.
Here he is.
Okay.
Here I am.
Good evening, Jose. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself, Brooks?
I'm doing great. I was just telling Stephanie, in the 4 years that we've been on the air, The studio is deep beneath the earth here in western Kentucky. Just got struck by lightning. So it knocked us off the air for a few minutes, and now we're back. So we're good to go now. And I was telling her that was a very auspicious exclamation.
Yeah, auspicious and synchronistic and prophetic.
Right. Well, Stephanie's book, Biographer of a Time Traveler, does a great job at revealing the process of your life and the possible windows of vision through which you understand the Mayan past and how it came to you. And within the first few pages of the beginning of Stephanie's book, you're quoted as saying, my job as a visionary is to envision the best possible outcome for humanity. If I don't do it, who will? How did you discover that the human culture was on the wrong path to enlightenment?
Well, I had a deep intuition about that my whole life from the time that I had a vision on top of the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan, when I was 14. My perception in that experience that I had was that there was just a phenomenal gulf between the knowledge that of such a cosmic scale that had constructed the pyramid temple site of Teotihuacan, a great gulf of knowledge between that and what I had been experiencing in modern day Mexico City, where everybody was agog about the new Sears and Roebuck. And I felt that something, there was already something amiss. And my path took me many ways. That was the core, the seed of my vision. And through my college and graduate studies, I had a strong sense like there was a separation between what I perceived to be our divine sacred nature and the profane nature of the modern world. And my study of modern art showed me that the art and the culture been moving more and more away from nature, that the human species in some ways seemed to be becoming more and more alienated from nature. And when I studied that in contrast with the studies of the Mayan calendar and civilization, it felt like here was a system of what I would today call celestial harmonics, a mathematical system based on 20 and not on 10 that integrated very, very phenomenal levels of cycles into its measurements of time. That, again, here was another great contrast to the modern time. So I began to live on the what I call the Mayan cycles, the 13-day cycles and the 20-day cycles and so on. And in 1989, when I was in Geneva, Switzerland, I visited the Museum of the Clock, which is billed as the Museum of Time. And while in that museum, I had just the most phenomenal aha experience and realized that the root of the modern disorder was that the human species is the only species living according to its own concept and perception of time, which is encoded in the mechanical clock, and this and also in the arbitrary and irregular measure of the 12-month Gregorian calendar. And I saw that having lived by these artificial devices, particularly this mechanistic device, for some 200 or 300 years, that the human species had just literally veered off the track, was living in its own, what I call time warp, its own bubble, and just heedlessly going on exploiting all the natural resources for its own mechanistic needs, and not perceiving the fact that it was destroying its very basis, its very foundations. It seemed to me like the human species was like a being sitting off in a tree branch and sawing through the tree branch, not realizing it was going to fall off. So
that's a somewhat long-winded response,
but
I know there are a lot of students out there, and I meet them, and you do too, who are sort of repeating the mantra that life is all an illusion and nothing here in this life matters. But so how would you help us perhaps understand that maybe we could have a more accurate view of what this mortal experience really is about?
Well, you know, when people say that life is an illusion, of course, you know, at one level, that may be so, that life is a projection of a particular mental frequency or perception that we have. But the fact of the matter is, we have to take responsibility for who we are and what we're doing here. And that's the most primary, what I would say, code that we have to live by, is that are we taking responsibility for our lives? Are we taking responsibility for our own thoughts? Are we taking responsibility for our own thoughts and actions? And are we living according to a perception of the universe that actually engages us as an evolving unit or member of this spectrum of cosmic evolution. I think that when people start thinking that life is an illusion and saying things like that, it's actually a cop out.
I think so too. I think that, you know, we have to realize that we're sovereign beings and we're in charge of our own life condition. We created who we are and what we're doing for a living or not doing for a living, for that matter. And, you know, there's a certain shock, a certain awakening that comes to people when they realize that, hey, I made this mess, and the only person that's going to get me out of it is me. And if, like you say, they just cop out, they just say, well, it's all illusion anyway. I'll just wait till I die and go to heaven and try to keep my nose clean while I'm here. But in the meantime, they don't do anything. They're not engaged with life.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It's kind of, you see people like that who also say, well, it's all in the flow. And I don't have to do anything about it because it'll just take care of itself. But that's a pretty erroneous approach.
Yeah, I think that too. Now, there have been some awakening events. You know, humanity, or at least modern humanity, has been going along minding its own business. And then in 1949, Alberto Ruiz was in Palenque, and he made a startling discovery. Can you tell, can you describe how this might have changed the course of humanity with its implications?
That's a very interesting way of putting it, Brooks. Yes, in 1949, Alberto Ruiz was... he had been put in charge of the archaeological site of Palenque by the National Institute of Archaeology and History of Mexico. And Palenque was at that time getting a reputation for being one of the more incredible and especially artistic of the great Mayan temple cities. And so he was in charge of it, and he was up on top of the very perfectly formed temple, what was called the Temple of the Inscriptions. The Mayan pyramids are stepped pyramids, and usually on the top of the pyramid they have a number of rooms or temple type, what are called temple structures or temple rooms. There's three of them on top of the pyramid of the inscriptions. And in the middle one, where there are 140 different inscriptions, Alberto Ruiz was looking around, and he saw on the floor there that seemed like there was some kind of markings in the stone that seemed kind of odd to him. So he started, he looked at that, and he wondered if that meant that you could pry this stone up from the floor. And so he did. He pried the stone up from the floor, and he saw like a bit of rubble, earth and rubble beneath it. But as he was looking, he noticed towards the back there by the wall, there was a piece of tile. He brushed away the dirt, and he saw that it looked like it was a tile tube. He looked a little further, and it looked like there was actually, it was leading someplace. It took him, he decided he'd better dig. So carefully excavating, it took him 3 years until he finally dug all the way down through a stairwell that wound its way down to the bottom of the pyramid, just beneath ground level. There was a small little hallway there, and he saw that this tile tube went into a stone wall. And he looked there at the stone wall. This was June 15th, 1952 now. And he looked at that stone wall and where that tile went in. He saw a large trapezoidal stone. It was just like one of these Indiana Jones movies. He pushed at the stone in several places, and he finally pushed at one end, and voila, the stone swung open. And with the flashlights and the torches, they looked in there, and there was an incredible chamber. He later said that as soon as he pushed that stone door open, that this rush of air came out. He said he could literally feel the thoughts of the last people who had been inside this crypt over 1,000 years ago. When he looked in there, he saw a very, very intricately architectured crypt, in the bottom of which was a large stone sarcophagus with an incredible sculpted lid. And he knew that this was an amazing discovery. Nothing like this had ever been discovered in the New World. Here was the tomb of some at that time unknown Mayan priest king or someone that had come to light. No one had ever thought that the pyramids had tombs like this. In fact, there still is no other pyramid that has been found like this. This is a completely unique phenomenon. That took him some figuring out, and by November of that year, he was able to lift up that sarcophagus lid and find beneath it the remains of a skeleton of a man who was rather large by Mayan standards, someone who would have been almost 6 feet tall. Most Mayans are maybe 5.5 feet. And it was just incredibly overlaid with all sorts of precious jade. In the right hand was a jade sphere, and the left hand was a jade cube. And there was an incredible jade mask and many other pieces of jade. It turned out to be the tomb of Pakal, the great Pakal, or Pakal Votan, the most singular personality in all of Mayan history. And the discovery of this tomb occurred at a very, very precise point. As it turned out from the research, it turned out that Pakal died in the Christian year 683. He had his tomb prepared, and from the time of his death, when his body was laid in the tomb, then the pyramid was built above it. That took 9 years. And then it was dedicated in the year 692. It was exactly 1,260 years from the dedication of the tomb in 692 to its discovery. And then from 692 to 2012, it's 1,320 years. As I later discovered, these numbers were very precise. 1260 is the artificial timing frequency, and 1320 is the natural timing frequency, and those are the precise years of the tomb from its dedication to discovery, 1260, from its dedication to the closing of the cycle in 2012, 1320. So when I later was putting this information together, I saw, this was part of the prophecy that when my tomb is discovered, humanity will be living in the artificial time and of the 1260 frequency, but within 60 years at the closing of the cycle, the humanity will be returning to a natural time of the 1320 frequency.
Wow, that's completely fascinating. Is it true that Votan had 6 toes and 6 fingers?
That is not true. There was some other Mayan that was depicted. It might have been his son or someone who had 6 toes and 6 fingers, but it was not him.
Maybe it was his son. Yeah, it was his son. So, you know, speaking of synergistic times and how things time out, the very next year after this discovery was made by Mr. Ruse, you arrived in Mexico with your father. You were 14 years old because you decided to take a trip to Mexico, and you were very excited about this. What did you discover on this trip?
Well, that was, as I said, that was when, you know, when I was told about that trip, you know, we had been living in the United States for about 7 years, and my father really wanted to get back there. And I, of course, had been brought up in Mexico in my earliest years. So when he told me and my twin brother that we were heading back there, I got very excited. I had studied some of his books, and I knew also from some things that he said that there was this ancient civilization down there. So when I heard that, something lit up in me, and all I wanted to do was get to the pyramids. So as I said, as it turned out, when we went down there, and my uncle and my father took us to the pyramids probably in the middle of the summer of 1953, I got we went to Teotihuacan, and I got to the Pyramid of the Sun, which I recognized from some place deep inside of me. I went running up to the top of that pyramid, and as I stood up there and looked around, I had a great awakening type of experience where everything became very lucid, very clear. Actually, everything became bathed in a white light, and I understood things that were beyond my comprehension at that point, but in an inner way, I understood as I mentioned earlier, that there was a vast gulf between the knowledge, the cosmic knowledge of those who constructed Teotihuacan, and the knowledge that was guiding modern humanity in its present state. And that perception, as I said, is what guided me through my life. It was a remembering that occurred to me, and it was a remembering that I knew was going to be the lodestone of my life. It would be what was leading me on, and I knew that I had to learn everything about the ancient knowledge that had gone into the construction of this cosmic city, and I knew that whatever way possible that my mission was to bring this knowledge back to modern humanity in such a way that it would help demonstrate to them the higher cosmic vision and perhaps be of assistance in leading them back to living in the more natural cosmic cycles of the universe.
Well, it was pretty clear, at least by then, that modern man was kind of going in the wrong place, in the wrong direction. We'd had 75 years of the most devastating wars, since Earth has been in existence, and I don't think we're through it yet. But a couple of years ago, I climbed up to the top of the Temple of the Moon, and after I recovered from the climb, because the city's at about 8,000 feet, and the stairs are about a 45-degree angle, and they're tall. It takes quite a bit of effort to get to the top of one of these, but you sit down up there and you look at the scope of this city and the Avenue of the Dead, and you just wonder, because, you know, those aren't the only two structures. There are dozens and dozens of these. You know, some are covered with dirt because that area is quite windy and dusty, and the grass gets settled in and they get recovered up like little hills. But you look at the scope of the city and you say, man, what kind of intellect, what kind of organization, what kind of social order could have built a city of such magnificent scope in the middle of Mexico? It's just breathtaking, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, as I learned when I returned to my home in Minnesota, and I was working in the library, I learned from picking up a book there on the ancient Maya by Sylvanus Morley, that the civilization of the Maya, which was contemporary with the Teotihuacan, only farther south, that these people had this incredible astronomical and mathematical system. They had a system, I guess what we could call a mathematical astronomy, and had very, very accurate measurements of the different cycles of the various planets in relationship to the Earth, and in particular had this phenomenal mathematical system, which, again, when I saw that, I recognized that it's written in what's called a dot bar notation, which is the use of dots and bars. They can write any number you want, and up into infinitesimal levels. And I studied that, and I learned that immediately, and I knew that this was another piece of the puzzle. But I could see, well, I asking myself questions now. What were these people doing with this kind of mathematics? What were these people doing with these kinds of astronomical perceptions? What were these people doing with this level of what you might call cosmic geometrical thinking that they could apply to urban design and temple and pyramid structures and so on? Well, what was that all about? That was always a burning question with me.
Well, the answers aren't really there in Teotihuacan. There's not much art. There's not many records that are left. It's sort of like the inhabitants just, got aboard something, took every possession they had with them, and they left. And there are a few paintings of Nephilim and things like that on the walls, but other than that, they don't really have a lot of records left behind. It's kind of puzzling. And I'm sure it was for you, too. And by the time you were in the 10th grade, rather than be a mathematician, your artistic ability began to really take flight. So how did you see art as a way to expressing the visions that were coming to you at this time?
Well, to me, the whole expression of Teotihuacan, it was a grand work of art. And I could also see that from the other studies I was making, that as I said, there was a difference in the artistic perception of the Maya and of Teotihuacan, the Toltecs, and the artistic expression of modern art of modern times, and which I perceived later on I could articulate as being the difference between a perception of sacred order and a perception that sense of sacred order is lacking or missing. My father had kind of introduced me into art, and I had found art had always been a vehicle of a vehicle for expressing the deepest essence or inner intuitions of my being. And so I saw that also, that in places like Teotihuacan or among the Mayan cities, that the art that was produced had a great harmonic effect, like the layout of Teotihuacan has a cosmically harmonic effect. And I saw it seems like the purpose of art really is to create harmony. And the harmony that you find in some of that sacred art, you also find underneath it has a great mathematical order or mathematical design or geometry to it. I didn't really, in my later artistic explorations, I didn't see that much of a difference between mathematical structures and artistic expression. Those actually go hand in hand.
Well, as is evidenced by the quality and style of your art, and we're going to discuss that more in the next hour. Jose, we need to take a quick break. We just play a musical piece so that our affiliates can play some commercials, and then we'll be right back. So
okay.
My guest is Jose Arguez, and we'll be back right after this short musical break. Just relax a little bit, get some water, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Just wanted to remind you that June 19th through the 21st, the H2O live concert is going to take place. What city? 26 different cities. All the musicians are retuning their instruments to 528 hertz. This is the frequency of love. It is being advertised as the largest earth healing event in history. If you want to know more about it, go to the H2O Live banner at X Squared Radio. Click on it. Our friend is putting that together, and I'm telling you, it's going to be the most amazing event. We invite you to take place in it, either attend it or listen in to it, because it's going to be really an amazing concert. 26 different concerts, 26 different cities, all coordinated together at the same time to, in an attempt to try to heal the Earth's water. I know that really sounds like an amazing feat, but it's one of those things that is difficult to understand. You need to go to the website, learn more about it, talk to our friend Leonard Horowitz about it, and see if you can't get a feel for it, see if it resonates with you. This is going to be a historic event. You might as well take place in it. Don't let it pass you up. We'll be back in about 60 seconds. Welcome back, my friends, to X Squared Radio, coming to you live from deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky. Our guest tonight is Jose Arguelles. The book is 2012, Biography of a Time Traveler, written by Stephanie South. She introduced us tonight in our first hour. This is a three-hour program if you're not getting all 3 hours. Let us know at info@x2-radio.com, and we'll take care of the rest. We will open up the phone lines for the next 2 hours, so if you want to call in, do so on the toll-free lines or the 530-776-5154 line. You have a rare opportunity to ask Jose a question. If you've read the book or if you're wondering about 2012, this is the man with the perceptions. Welcome back, Jose.
Hey, I'm here.
All right. You know, in our rational world of total conformity, that we should teach us that we should enjoy moderation in all things. William Blake is quoted in Stephanie's book as saying, the road to wisdom is paved with excess. That's kind of interesting. Do you feel that you needed to enter another state of mind to unite with your whole being?
Well, you know, living in this highly, as you said, conformity-ridden and caged existence, we often use the phrase, you have to get out of the box. And, you know, if you really, really do want to get a fresh perspective beyond the conditioned limiting views which we're brought up in, or which actually become what we think is our personality, well, then you do have to break out. And in this modern age, it's the peculiarities of that are such that we often have to resort to some type of psychotropic substance or something like that to expand our mind so we can see what it is like outside of the box. And in that way, if you don't go to experience the extremes, well, you really can't really know what the possibilities are, or even what your own limits are, or even what your own boundaries are. So in my life, I've found that it was necessary, especially in my earlier part, to have these experiences to understand what the limits were, to see what it's like outside the box, to get a different perspective on our society and on our humanity, and in which direction we are going, and how we might then ameliorate our ways and find a better and more cosmic way.
Well, I certainly understand that. You don't have to go very far. Go to Egypt, go to just about anywhere, and you see that the shamans, the enlightened ones, the ones who connected Earth with the stars, who understood the purpose of life and tried to guide their people, all began, at least what's represented in the art, began their awakening, at least in the beginning, through the use of psychotropic substances. So in Egypt, I think it was marijuana or cannabis that they used. But interesting, you know, at least what I gather is we don't, when we're born, we don't really think in words. We think in pictures. We think in icons and images. And it's only through the rationalization of the human being that we're forced to truncate our true expression and try to put it into correct grammar and express it. So I'm curious, because I know many of our listeners have artistic propensities, as do I from time to time, and in receiving instruction in art, the same thing happens. Did you ever feel like the methods were afraid of full expression?
Well, yeah, I found that it was necessary always to experiment, but I also saw that, like, in the different art schools, that people would develop what are called different canons of style, and I always try to whatever, something new comes along, then it becomes stylized, and it becomes a stereotypical almost type of cliche. So this seems to be a common process where some original perception then becomes a fashion, and then it becomes a cliche, and then its original essence is gone. So the point of art is always to take us to some stage where we our imagination couldn't even imagine being. We always have to be going past another boundary. That's why much art has a kind of shock value when you first see it, because we have to continuously be awakening our perceptions, and particularly when we live in this particular in this age in which we're living, in which there is so much information and there are so many people, and the possibilities seem to be infinite. And at the same time, is everyone really expressing something individual, or is every individual just being a monotonous carbon copy of something trying to be individual? So there's a lot of challenges and a lot of paradoxes there. So again, it's the question of like, well, what are we doing here, and how do we establish ourselves as to me always, how do we establish ourselves as cosmic beings? How do we maintain the touch with the cosmic stream of life that is pouring through the universe? And how do we maintain that instead of just becoming our own closed circuit feedback loops?
Oh, I like that. That's good. We often refer to human beings as biological transducers. So the idea that we have these feedback loops that keep us on the, quote, straight and narrow of society is probably what's limiting us as a being locked inside the human body.
Yeah, that's...
No, go ahead.
Yeah, that's very much so. And to break out and to find a larger definition of what it is to be human, you use the phrase biological transducer. In my perception, that I feel that what we're actually intended to be is biosolar telepaths, and that we receive. You know, we live. Everything lives by the sun. And all of life is generated by the sun, and everything that lives, if it weren't for the sun, there wouldn't be any life here. And we're receiving consciously and unconsciously these vibrations all the time. And what the ancient Maya knew was that the psychic, what we call paranormal aspects of the mind, the psychic telepathic aspects of the mind, are very much in tune with solar frequencies, and that it's actually the solar projections of solar frequencies that actually activate our paranormal faculties, that we're meant to be, our minds are meant to be opened and expanded out to be receiving and being in communion with these higher psychic solar frequencies, which the Mayans had a word for that called Tin Kinan Ta, the psychic energy power of the solar radiations or vibrations. So that's what I feel is like the direction. That's how we're supposed to be defining ourselves. That's the direction we're supposed to be going. But we've completely put a gigantic civilizational blanket and wrapped that around our brain, so we can't perceive the solar cosmic vibrations that are coming into us.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience and also from reading your book that intunement or that connection is far more satisfying than, say, driving a Cadillac. One of the things that we're fortunate to have in the book, and also with you being here on the program tonight, is many people realize that they've been asleep their whole life, or they're around people who are asleep. I mean, they drive down the highway next to us every single day. You look over in their driver window, and sure enough, they're asleep. They may be driving their car and having their eyes open and breathing and everything, but they're not aware of who they are. They're locked into this economic engine that we call humanity. In the fall of 1962, you were about 22 years old, and although you had, discovered that institutional education was a social game, how did you come to terms with it to pursue a higher degree at the University of Chicago? How did you even though you were awakened and you were in some sense frustrated with the structure of society, you felt that it was necessary to get to where you needed to be. So I want to know how you came to terms with that and what you brought to the University of Chicago.
Well, that's a very good point. I had dropped out for a short while there, but when I can only speak for myself, I felt like I had a very deep inner calling. I didn't understand precisely what the whole extent of this calling was, but I knew I had this calling, and I knew it was in order to fulfill this calling that I had to get to some higher place than where I was at that time. And when I looked around at the options that were available to me, when I saw all that, I said, well, if I'm going to elevate myself and to get any credibility so I can really begin to understand and articulate what this is, I'm just going to have to jump into this graduate school thing and immerse myself in it. I always had like two selves that were working. There was always a higher self that was kind of monitoring me, and then there was my third dimensional self that knew it had to go in and play certain games. But this higher self was always there and was always kind of leading me in particular direction, so that the information that I was gaining from playing the game, that information was then being processed and utilized to create steps on a ladder. And so that's how I did it. And sometimes it became more difficult than others, and sometimes it wasn't so. But it was always like that. I always had this, whatever it was, I was always looking at everything through split vision. And one side it was, okay, all these people are saying, do this, do it this way. And the other side is saying, yeah, do it that way. But when you get to this point over here, forget it, because you'll be free and you can go in another direction.
Yeah, because you'll have new knowledge that you don't have right now with which
exactly.
To...
And all the way through, when I was a professor teaching different classes in art history, I always would find classes or areas that I hadn't taught before, so I could learn about them.
Oh, and I like then, it. I like, because you never
learned
it.
And that way, then I would be learning about it and teaching it at the same time. And that's what made it exciting and interesting for me, and also gave me information that I needed to have, because I knew one of the requirements that I needed to fulfill in order to complete my mission was to have as broad a spectrum knowledge and understanding of the universal history of the human civilization and all of the different cultures. So I would teach the history of Chinese arts, I could study Chinese civilization, I'd teach the history of Indian arts, I could understand the art of India and its civilization, I'd teach Native American arts, I could understand the different cultures of Native Americans, and so on. So in this way then, I was like always creating the spectrum for myself, because I also always had a perception that this is just one world, one earth, one planet, and as such, it is a whole. It's a living entity, a whole. And so everything that takes place on that whole, some way or another, relates to everything else that takes place on that whole to create a much larger whole type of planetary cosmovision. That was my method.
You mentioned earlier that you looked at things through split vision. One is the tactile vision, you know, that consumes peas and carrots here on this planet. And the other one is a higher self. Who did you discover was the higher self?
Well, I discovered there's a number of them. And there's your own essence self, okay, that is, you know, like the little voice, the intuition that says, don't do that, or it says, this way. there's that self. That's your fourth dimensional self. And then there's other levels. Okay, then I found that at certain point, even in the 1960s when I was painting my doors of perception, I started, as they say, hearing voices. And I realized that there was aspects or parts of the mind that gave you access to other dimensions. If you put yourself into particular almost trance-like states that you can experience these and get information that way. In the 1980s, after I'd finally been able to visit the tomb of Pakal Votan in 1976, I went through a particular difficult phase in my life, needing to integrate the deeper information and come to terms with some of the more shallow aspects of my mundane existence. And then after some cathartic experiences, then I was in touch then with Pakal Votan. I felt also that this was a very important connection. It was very much the force that was behind my writing of the Mayan factor, and then I realized, well, you know, actually, as I went on through this in the 80s and 90s, I actually realized we're actually multidimensional beings. As we wake up more and more, if we follow a path of awakening, that we actually start tuning into different layers and levels of intelligence that permeate the cosmos, and that these connect us to aspects of our being that are actually multidimensional, put us into contact with aspects of ourselves that are even more cosmic and connect us with other say galactic civilizations. At least that's my case, my experience. I've had to really work at it.
Well, and most everyone does too, and we tend to think in order A, B, C, D, or 1, 2, 3, 4, and it doesn't always come that way. It kind of comes scattered or in crystalline form. And not to be too linear about this experience, but while you were at the University of Chicago, as though your higher self had led you to at least go to a, quote, institution of higher learning, you did meet Gerald Vogel. And you participated in some dream experiments. So tell us about that experience.
Oh, yes. You know Gerald Vogel.
Well, I've read some of his work. It's pretty fascinating how he
Well, I didn't know. You know, I just knew I needed to find a psychiatrist. And he was at the university, and he was recommended to me. So I started doing psychotherapy with him, and then he said, you know, I have this dream laboratory. And he knew I had a twin brother. He first wanted my twin brother and myself, but my twin wouldn't have anything to do with that. So I said, but I thought it was a great idea. I was fascinated, and so I'd go there a couple times a week. At first, I thought, how am I going to go to sleep with this? They put 17 electrodes on your head and then they plug you into a wall. But I got sleep. Every time you have a dream, you hear a voice saying, Mr. Arguelles, will you please tell us your dream? And you just roll over and tell them your dream. Well, I liked that because it showed me, because like they'd wake you up right after the dream and showed me how vivid and intricate dreams were. It just amazed me. I needed that kind of experience to see this aspect of our consciousness. One night when they called me back, I had a really hard time coming back, and it was like I was spinning through a vortex, and I swore, you know, as I told the dream, I knew that like I was actually coming from another time. This wasn't a regular dream experience. It was an experience I felt that was occurring sometime in the earlier part of the 19th century. I was walking down a beach in Greece, and I was talking with this other man, another gentleman, and we were talking about the effects of industrialization on human culture, on human art, and the human mind, and what its effects would be like in the coming century. And it was a very, very vivid experience. I could see the beach. I knew it was in Greece. I could see the cliffs, everything like that. And then I was called back from that, and it was, like I said, coming back from that dream, it was like swirling through a vortex of time, and I got back, and I told it like it was a dream, but I knew it wasn't a dream. Then that was like, I guess, in 1964 or something, and then in 1966, I was traveling in Europe, and I was in Greece, and I knew I wanted to go to Cape Sunion in Greece because I knew that's where Lord Byron had been before he died in the Greek Wars for Independence there. And I got down to this place at Cape Sunion, and I knew, I said, that's the place. That was where I was. That confirmed to me that I had been back there. I was either in the consciousness of Lord Byron or whatever, but I had time traveled to this place. And then was able to find it later on. I found that in my life, dreams, synchronicities, precognitive visions, all connected to some higher web of conscious unfoldment of life. And I've always been led by that. So, like, for instance, that dream, past life, whatever, past time experience, and then going to Cape Sunion two years later and confirming that was very important to me, because those kinds of things told me that, like, that the life I'm living is a function of a larger pattern that's unfolding. And even though most of the time I can't see it down here, or sometimes I might even get so messed up I forget that it even is, that is what's actually going on. And because of that, every experience I have is actually a further unfolding of this higher pattern or this higher dimensional template.
Mm. Yeah, I like the word unfoldment. It's kind of a key word in the science of teleology, which is that there is some kind of grand pattern that almost predestines us to travel and learn and grow and even de-evolve in certain ways. I don't really personally agree with that, you know, there's some kind of predestination or some kind of locked-in future to which we are marching, and there's nothing we can do about it. I like to think that it's kind of all in motion, and we can move humanity through planes of existence based on our own intention and our own involvement in it as sovereign beings. But there can be no denying that there is some kind of past history, some kind of past energy that exists and into which we can tap in not only dream states, but in meditative states. But my question is, did you think that your experience in Teotihuacan, the books that you were reading, and the dream work were all connected somehow?
Yeah, I definitely would get that sense of it. As I said, I knew that the experience of Teotihuacan was like a key, and it was so deep in my being and such a deep expression of my being that it stayed with me, as I said, kind of like a lodestone. And as I would have other experiences, then they would kind of like I would kind of like see how they gathered around this central experience of Teotihuacan. That taught me many things. It taught me, like, that there's cosmic and sacred order, and that there's profane order. It taught me that there's higher dimensional experiences, and that there is the normal, everyday, quote unquote, ordinary experiences. It taught me that there was type of civilization that had existed that knew about these types of things, that there was civilization that we had today that had forgotten about these types of things. So my experiences, my synchronistic or paranormal experiences, would group themselves around the central fact in one of these categories, so-called, so that I could sense that there was, as I said, this larger type of pattern of continuous unfoldment that was occurring. And as my life moved more and more into you know, in my 40s and in my 50s, I could see how all of this was actually an interconnected process, you know, and then I saw that in some ways that all of this process had me pointed to 2012, that this was the point and the purpose of the varieties of synchronistic and paranormal experiences that I had were all directing me to a deeper and deeper understanding, and pointing to this event point, event horizon called 2012. So all my life is organized to that point.
Mm. Well, and I realize that you concentrated your life on a very eloquent description and production of art. You discovered a sort of, you know, cosmic style in medieval art that most missed. Do you think these historical artists somehow saw what you saw and tried to express it?
Oh, I'm quite convinced of that. I believe that, particularly in the earlier stages of art prior to the Industrial Age, where there was more of a focus on a sacred or cosmic vision that many artists attempted to, well, many artists experienced and then attempted to express the sense of cosmic wholeness. And I saw that this to me was like the purpose of human existence and the purpose of human expression was to be able to experience in oneself the cosmic wholeness and then to express it in whatever different ways that can come up, because like we are actually very dynamic flows of cosmic energy that is concentrated into this little organism that we are, and that is continuously seeking to find ways of expressing this the dynamism of the cosmic wholeness.
Well, I know when I look at medieval art, I used to think that most of it featured spiritual aspects with Jesus or other saints depicted as these cosmic beings with veils and wings and various auras around them. And I used to think it was because the church was the sole source of funding and approval in those days, but maybe there really was a deeper meaning in these expressions. What were your thoughts?
Yeah. They could see those halos, you know, those are the auras, you know. Lots of times you see the whole body is in this type of aura. And you see that also like in Buddhist art. I could see that the Buddhist art and the Christian art were very similar. The depiction of Buddhas or Buddhist holy figures. They have like the halos around the head, the auras around the body, that they're actually expressing the experience of advanced enlightened states of being. And advanced enlightened states of being are states of being that are cosmic in nature, where we are realizing our cosmic nature. And when I talk about that, realizing our cosmic nature, that we have a perception of on the one hand of a profound clarity of our perceptual and mental experience, and at the same time have a sense that we are somehow or other embodying some profound cosmic principle or cosmic function. And that comes about through practicing different spiritual techniques, and through those different techniques at clearing away the conditioned aspects of the self, so that we come to the true essence self, and that true essence self abides in the ever living cosmic present now.
Well, when I look at your art, I get an immediate, almost inspiration from it. It's almost iconic. It's the patterns and the colors and the use of texture and everything. I, for one thing, can't figure out how you did it with your hands, but the dreams and the visions and things that come to you in meditation, the voices that speak to you and from these ancient concepts to you. Were they always in a language that you could understand, these voices?
Just about. Only rarely were they not. And I think that, you know, we have to understand that, like, there's when we experience things that within the higher level of cosmic intelligence and higher dimensional intelligence that is attempting to establish or communication, whatever, they automatically know how to transduce whatever the particular thought or communication is, to transduce it into the medium of the language that you comprehend. That just happens instantaneously. That's a part of a higher intelligence function. So it's almost always like that. I get a lot of information through mathematical codes as well, which is somewhat different. I've been introduced to certain mathematical codes, and which I'm working with right now, and learning how to transduce these codes into what we call grammatical meaning.
Well, I know in looking at your art, it isn't just it's so expressive in the sense that it brings the pattern, this sort of sacred geometry to the canvas. And, you know, although I've seen a lot of it in my life, to go back and look at the originals, like your works in the book Mandalas, this was, you know, mind altering for people, because although people had spoken about it, and certainly go to Tibet and see all the mandalas that you can imagine, to see a modern artist creating new messages with mandalic style meant that you were connected somewhere with the same source that those ancient artists were connected with. Did you ever feel that connectedness?
Yeah, I actually did, from some experiences I had in the 1960s. Actually, after the first or second time, I remember I took LSD and I went to, I was in Paris and I went to the Musée Guimet, which is a large collection of Oriental art and much Tibetan art. And then that was my first exposure to Tibetan art. And I saw immediately the similarity between some of the perceptual experiences I'd been having on the LSD and the Tibetan mandalas that I saw. I felt I recognized them. I saw that was actually experiences that I was having in my own optical nerves. And later on, when I'd been painting these mandalas for a while, and I met my Tibetan teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, he also remarked on that. He looked at them. He hadn't seen these paintings before, and he looked at them for a little while, and then he looked at me with a sly grin and said, "Oh, I see you know all about this tantra, don't you?" Well, that was just his way of saying that he recognized that I recognized the perceptual patterns of the underlying the Tibetan mandalas, and that I had been able to project these same patterns into modern mandalas, let's say, that still communicated the same underlying essence of unity.
Now, what is it that, what the message of unity, what is it that humanity was being united with in your art?
Well, and through my art, what I always proposed or felt to show was that all of existence is a unity. That we create these dualistic worlds because of our egos, because of the conditionings of social, historical, ideological factors. But in actuality, that everything is a unity, and I hope that through my art that people could remember that they could look at some of this art and dissolve their ego boundaries for a few minutes and have a cosmic memory of the unity that actually is, that we are all living as a part of a continuum, a dynamic continuum that is always a unity, and that to live a healthier, saner life, that ultimately we evolve out of the ego state into this higher unitive state. I believe that that is where we are all going to our to the next stage of our evolution on this planet.
Now, I understand by your description of unity that you're not talking about a singularity, a single point of conformity, but rather, and perhaps not only an earthbound race of humanity, but perhaps that humanity does expand across the universe, but that perhaps this unity is more descriptive in the sense that we are all sovereign individuals working in harmony and living in harmony one with another. Is that a correct?
Yeah, correct. That's right. That each individual has an essence nature. And that essence, the whole point of life is somehow or other getting back to that essence nature, connecting with that so one is one with it. And each one of us has that, as each one of us arrives at the reunion, let's say, with their own essence nature through whatever spiritual or psychological techniques and experiences, that then that one regains one's true autonomy, one's true sovereignty, and that's the union of sovereign, autonomous beings who have attained their essence nature, who recognize in each other that they have realized that, and that they are able thereby to live in a higher state of autonomy and unity, where there is no need for government, no need for control, no need for coercion, no need for fear, that we are able to live in this level of harmony and unity, and it does depend on the sovereign autonomy of the individual. But when you have a group of individuals living in sovereign autonomy, and the fear factor has been erased, then you also have the potential and the capacity to enter into the truly unitive telepathic state of mind, which that's what gets you access to the cosmic intelligence in other parts of the galaxy or in other galaxies or in other parts of the universe or even into higher dimensions.
I like it. I actually, in just closing my eyes and listening to you describe that, I pictured a field of flowers, not all the same type of flower, but all different flowers, perfectly living in harmony and peace in the same field. No need for them all to be daisies or poppies, but individual flowers with their own beauty and their own purpose, all living together.
That's absolutely correct. You know, you can see this like, I've been living in Australia and in New Zealand for a little while, and they have a lot of birds there. And you can see this also with the birds, all the different bird tribes. You know, sometimes they get into a little squabble, but you know, you'll see all these different kinds of birds. They're all you know, in the same place. They're all doing their thing, and you know, they're all you know, they all get along.
You know, I'm most curious about your experience with one of my most favorite people, Buckminster Fuller. In physics, we see him as the pioneer in nanostructures with carbon, known as buckyballs and buckytubes. What was the more esoteric side of this visionary physicist?
Well, I had several experiences with Bucky, and my first ones were through correspondence. We were both writing for a journal at that time in the late 60s called Main Currents in Modern Thought, and I had written some pieces, and I noticed that he, and some of the articles that he was writing, I saw that there was I felt some kind of similarity of thought. And then I noticed that he kept talking about, you know, synergy, and I had been researching little-known French psycho-mathematician named Charles Henry, who I noted had been talking about synergy years and years and years before Bucky had. And I also noticed that this man had died in 1926, and the last thing he had written before he died, this French psychomathematician, Charles Henry, the last thing he had written before he died was something called Post-Mortem Survival of Consciousness. And I noticed that in Bucky's work, he talked about how, and this was in 1926 when this was written, and I noticed in Bucky's work, he said that he started working with the concept of synergy in 1927. So I wrote to Bucky, and I suggested to him that as part of the post-mortem survival of consciousness, that Bucky had gotten the synergy concept from Charles Henry, who had been working with it for about 20 or 30 years prior. And he wrote me back, and he said, "That's marvelous. I think that's absolutely correct." He went on to say, I believe that that's how we get our ideas, that they are transmitted to us. He said, "I believe that there is a band of thought that surrounds the planet, where all the thoughts that have ever been are in this band of thought." He said, he said to me that for instance, when I want to talk to my favorite people, who are the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers like Thales and Pythagoras and whomever there, that Miletus, that he says, I just go out and I start talking to them. I know they'll start talking back because I know how to tune into what part of the thought band that they're in. So that was very, very interesting, and I know what he was talking about. Well, nowadays we call that thought band the noosphere, and that led me to a lot of further studies in that. Well, we had some further correspondences, and then some 10 years later, I was living in Boulder, Colorado. A friend of mine had painted a mandala. Student of mine had painted a mandala entitled Jose's Dream. And I had a friend who lived nearby in Boulder, Francois de Chardonnay, and he loved that painting. He wanted to know if he could keep it for a while, and I said yes, he could. And then I got about this, some months later, I got a letter from my friend who said he'd like to have the painting, Jose's Dream, back. So I told Francois I needed to get the painting back. And the night before I went over to get the painting back, and the painting's called Jose's Dream, I had a dream of Bucky Fuller. And Bucky was singing You Are My Sunshine, My Only Sunshine. I thought, wow, that was a great dream. And so the next day I went to this man's house, Francois de Chardonnay's house, and I knocked on the door to get the painting, Jose's Dream, and he said, "Come on in." He said, "There's someone here who very much wants to meet you." And it was Bucky Fuller. And I had the night before been dreaming about him, and I went to get the painting Jose's Dream, and there was Bucky Fuller out of the dream into the real life. That was one of the most amazing synchronicities I ever experienced. So we sat down to talk about where we got our visions. And he told me that, I asked him, what was it in 1927 that it happened? And he said, I think it was something about after one of his children died or something like that. He was on the beach in Lake Michigan in Chicago. He was on the in a park there, and he said that he had this amazing vision at that time, and it showed him all the principles of synergy, and he knew that this was to be the defining aspect of his path in life. He went on and talked about certain things that were very interesting. He talked about the temple, but the way he talked about whatever this mystical thing the temple was, it was like a structure of higher dimensional guidance that he believed was the force of the factor that was moving him through his life. And I found it was a very similar kind of parallel, let's say, to the kind of perceptions I'd been having about my life, particularly since it was also in Chicago and Lake Michigan where in 1966 I also had another type of experience which showed me the way my life was to go, beginning with the painting of mandalas and then to proceed from there. So that was very, very beautiful meeting. I continued being in touch with Bucky up till the time he died. The last thing I had sent him was a manuscript copy of my book, Earth Ascending, which he received probably a week or two before he died, and later met his daughter, who told me that he had that manuscript, was on his desk at the time of his death. So that's my experiences with Bucky.
Very interesting. You know, we read the textbooks and we do the experiments and we benefit from the technology, not just in construction of physics and nanotechnology, but even in oncology and using Bucky's technology to encapsulate large elements like bismuth, and then we neutron activate them and use them to heal people. He just doesn't know how far and wide he has affected the universe with his ability to bring the visions that he got out there in the noosphere and create these mathematical carbon structures called nanotubes and or Bucky tubes and Bucky balls. Just now it's you just go to the shelf and get a jar of Bucky tubes, but before Buckminster Fuller, they didn't exist. So it just gives you an idea how great this inspiration can be and what forms it can come from and how ancient the sources can be. I know many people who study and employ the I Ching or the I Ching in their lives. They say millionaires don't use it, but billionaires do. What did the ancients know about patterns and the speed of the subconscious mind?
Well, I don't know, but from what you just said, I should be a billionaire by now. Listen,
you probably are on another plane.
Yeah, on another plane I am. I'm waiting for it to reach me. The Chinese, ancient Chinese, different ancient people, of course, had the perception of the unitary nature of existence. And what the Chinese discovered through the system later known as the I Ching was a method for understanding the underlying patterns of unity that create this phenomenal experience of phenomenal world that we have. And I was introduced to the I Ching in the mid-1960s, and particularly when I got to Princeton in 1966, I began to study it and to experiment with it and to use it. And I found that indeed it was a system that indeed I was able to open you to a deeper underlying perception of patterns in your life, what are maybe called through techniques that are often called like divination. But I found that through the method of the I Ching that I was able to get to much a deeper perception of the underlying patterns in my own life and in my own experiences. I also saw that in the I Ching there were structures of knowing and structures of being that all combined to create a very comprehensive whole picture of the reality that we live in. I had written a number of articles on the I Ching in the late 1960s. One of them was titled "The I Ching as a Prelude to a Post-Scientific System," indicating that it had through its method that it had a way of showing us the paranormal or telepathic nature of our existence and of our experience, and that I also was very deeply impressed by the act of the very profoundly mathematical nature of the I Ching. It's a binary system that starts with the yin and the yang, and then there's the four line parts, the old yin, the young yin, the old yang, and the young yang. And then that it goes into the 8 trigrams, and then that goes into the 64 hexagrams. So that obviously also is a corresponds to a very, very precise mathematical system and precise binary mathematical process. I continued my studies of the I Ching and my studies of the Mayan calendar side by side through the 1970s. And I always thought, you know, there's something about, particularly about the Mayan mathematical notation system, the dot bar system, which when you look at it, you know, and let your mind get loose, it has very interesting similarities of patterns to the hexagrams, the trigrams and hexagrams of the I Ching. And I always wondered if there was some connection between the I Ching system of 64 hexagrams and the Mayan calendar system based on this 1320 pattern. So the number 13 repeated 20 times to create something called the Dzogchen, which is the underlying mathematical basis of the amazing Mayan calendrical system. So, and I always wondered, well, is there a relationship between this 260 and this 64? On the outset, there wouldn't be, because 64 is 8 squared and 260 is 13 by 20. So I was thinking, I kept thinking about that, and then I was looking at studying some of Benjamin Franklin's mathematical wizardries, including his magic squares, and I came across Benjamin Franklin's magic square of 8, and then I said, aha, there it is, in a magic square of 8, with all the numbers of every row vertically and horizontally, every row will add up to 260. And I said, aha, that's the clue I was looking for. That's the relationship between the I Ching and the Dzogchen, the 64, 8 squared, and the 260, 1320, is that in the magic square of 8, every row vertically and horizontally adds up to 260. That's an amazing thing. And so I studied that a little bit, and then lots of amazing things occurred to me. This was about 1982 or 83. And from that, I saw all these different interlocking patterns of the I Ching, which at that time, then I also knew that the hexagrams of the I Ching are also describe precisely the language of the DNA, the 64 codons in the DNA. Their amino acid structures can be written with the binary on-off language of a solid line and a broken line. And so then I saw, oh, I see that if the I Ching is actually the same as the DNA code, and the DNA code arranged in a magic square adds up to 260, and that's the 1320 frequency of fourth-dimensional synchronization, that must be the pattern that governs the universal evolutionary process of the DNA and its unfolding on this planet is governed by this 1320, this 260 frequency, which was encoded in the Mayan calendar. And it's like these two big puzzle pieces, one from the Mayan civilization in Central America and another from Chinese civilization in Asia, that they came together, and I saw, how did they come together? And I saw, oh, I see, that's because together they create a unifying pattern that underlies the noosphere. That then this unifying pattern described as the Cybank, the information storage and retrieval system of the evolutionary life process of the stages of evolution, I should say, on our planet Earth here. And that became the basis of my book, Earth Ascending.
Absolutely stunning. Jose, we have a caller on line two. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
It's Ramon from New York.
Hi, Ramon. How do you like tonight's program?
I'm kind of like at all. I would love to clone you and put you in every school of every level to teach. But unfortunately, I can't do that.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's going to work either, Ramon, but it's a great idea.
I have like a book's worth of questions, so I'm going to try to narrow it down to less than 10 minutes. I want to start with the Egyptians and the pyramids in the Americas. Are you familiar with Anthony West's work?
Yes.
You know how he talks about the inside of the pyramids, how they went through very, they took a long time to smooth out the corners and make sure they were all rounded? Which he was asking himself the question, why would you go through all the trouble to round out every corner inside the pyramid? And did you find anything like that when you were in the pyramids in the Americas?
Well, you know, in some of the pyramids that's so, and particularly at Uxmal, they have that effect in one of the pyramids, the so-called Pyramid of the Magicians. But that's the only place that I know that, but I can't say I've thoroughly investigated that either.
According to Anthony West, it's so the energy traveling through the pyramids can travel perfectly, kind of like a feng shui, so the energy can
mm-hmm.
move
yes.
perfectly. The other question was, are you familiar with the, because some of the stuff you were talking about, dreams, sounds a lot like the Aboriginal way of thinking of the way dreams are. They don't look at dreams as like, oh, it's just the conscious trying to get rid of things. They look at it more as another life or more like reality. Hello?
I'm
here. I'm just waiting for Jose's answer.
Yeah.
You know, Aborigines are a little like the Hopis, too, in the sense that they're an indigenous people, and they had, you know, really ancient and I think very clear viewpoints on the ancient origin of humanity and its ultimate, destination. So although I don't know very much about Aboriginal history, the Hopis are something that is in the realm of expertise for Jose.
Well, yeah. Also, I'd have to agree that the perception of the dreams I've had. I mean, I think many dreams are like just your conscious processing of mundane experiences. But then there are also what Carl Jung calls great dreams, and those are the dreams where the larger unconscious of the cosmic conscious is actually talking or moving through you. And those I think that's the real getting down to the higher level or purpose of going to sleep.
I've experienced these dreams. I'm gonna explain them to you the best possible I can, because a lot of these dreams we don't have the vocabulary for them. But have you ever just been sitting there in less than a second? You have fully awake. You have a full dream that you can recall, but it's almost like you've been in these places that you cannot recall. Where are these places? I almost feel like they don't exist, but they're real, and you have like this life and this dream that it's almost separate from what your day to day life.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
sure.
Things work completely different in that realm, and you have a whole different way of carrying yourself.
Sure. That's when that happens. You know, sometimes when that happens, like in your waking life, yeah, and then suddenly, like in a kind of an instant or a flash like that. Those, to me, those experiences are like of parallel universe or alternative universe experiences that you that kind of break through at that moment, and you tune into one of the parallel life or parallel lives that you're playing through in other universes or other galaxies. You know, there's billions and billions of galaxies, and I believe that like we actually are living a number of lives simultaneously in these different universes or different galaxies, and sometimes we break through and we have some experience like that. Sometimes it's kind of like a deja vu experience. Sometimes we have it with much more clarity, as you're describing, Ramon, where you almost see like a different way that you're carrying yourself and so on. But yeah, I think that that's what we're dealing with, is that we are also having these parallel alternate life processes that are occurring simultaneously in other aspects of the universe or in other dimensions.
You know, we have a tendency to look at that only from our perspective, that we're reaching out into the maelstrom of all of our existences and trying to bring information here. But in doing that, we're also sending out our intention, and we're also realizing that our personalities out there in the cosmos and either other dimensions or other galaxies are also reaching out to us for
exactly.
information for them. And that connection is pretty amazing, that it's not just the future talking to the past, but even more importantly, it's the past talking to the future.
My last question, have you, sometimes I do these meditations where I'll keep my eyes completely open, stare at a wall, and focus on the peripheral vision.
Yes.
And all of a sudden I'll have these geometric shapes. Most of the time it's, a square with a rectangle inside the box, and sometimes they take on different colors. And I've been trying to figure out what's the meaning behind it. Is it some kind of exercise, or have you ever experienced anything
like that? Yeah, well, you have that experience on your peripheral vision, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As soon as I focus, I lose it.
Yeah, exactly. You have to keep your eyes in a very relaxed state. If you try to see it, it'll go away. But I have found that, and I've said this many times, that the real source of vision is in the periphery. Because, when we see what we're looking at, when we're focused and everything, which we need to do to get through this third dimensional plane, we're only allowing a limited amount of information in, and we're usually only allowing information in that we can reconstruct in a way that's going to be practical and useful. The amount of information that is actually available to the optical nerve or to any of our senses is far greater than what our perceptual mode will allow in order for us to function. So that method, like of relaxing your vision and then kind of allowing a kind of relaxed focus to occur on the peripheries, is a very powerful way of beginning to pick up information or structures that are available to us that we couldn't access in other ways. It's what's at the at the periphery of society that's significant, not what's in the middle of it. It's in the periphery of our senses that is actually sometimes more significant than what's right in the center of it. So that's a very good technique to continue to practice.
That's pretty profound. That society has again, truncated our reality by saying only what is in focus in the middle of your eye is what is real.
Exactly.
And, you know, the inner shaman inside of us is saying, no, you know, I I'm getting impulses from the periphery, too, and I'm not going to tell my brain to tune those out the way society has told me to. I'm going to make myself aware of them. And that's where this extra information is coming from.
They're usually dismissed as just optical illusion. But some other things, like sometimes I'll see like electricity just kind of, if I do it outside, I swear I can see like the atoms moving around and I can see electricity moving through the air. And
all that's available. Because all of that is stored in our optical nerve, and so we can actually begin to exercise it. Through relaxing our vision, you can begin to see those types of things.
The only real drawback is I'm getting better and better at it, and it's happening.
Thanks for your questions,
Ramon.
I'll keep listening offline. Thank you, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you so much, Ramon. Yeah, the only drawback with that kind of extra vision, and it's it creates these little pockets of hours and hours of experience and just a few seconds of reality, is that it's happening more and more while I'm driving. So I'm trying to get a control over that and not have it happen so unexpectedly, although I'm given to drift, you know, while I'm driving, so especially on long trips on the freeway, which is fine if you're a passenger.
You gotta watch it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you had a particular strong connection to an ancient being named Quetzalcoatl. So, and during your lectures at this time in your life, what was your understanding of this being?
Well, again, this Quetzalcoatl is a multi-dimensional being, and the spirit of Quetzalcoatl was evident to the consciousness of the ancient people of Mexico before the incarnate form. The incarnate form seems to have come up maybe several times, and it was associated with, on the first hand, of being the culture bringer, the one who brought the knowledge of mathematics, the knowledge of painting and writing and all of the arts and so on. And that would seem to be a very primordial figure. The figure that's closer at hand and more interesting is the figure that incarnated between 947 and 999 of the Christian era. That's a 52-year cycle. And this Quetzalcoatl, also known as Seacatl Topiltzin Quetzalcoatl, our Lord, one reed, Quetzalcoatl. He lived the archetypal pattern. He was born as a twin. He was one who had been awaited for a long time. He was born at a time after the closing of the great period of the Mayan civilization of Teotihuacan, of what's usually called the Classic period. He was born in the post-Classic period. Before the second stage of Mayan civilization got going. And he was educated by all the different knowledge holders that came from the different areas of the ancient civilization. They all met at one place at Xochicalco. They gave him all the education. He went and played out the pattern of being a king and then of losing his kingdom, and then played out the pattern of wandering in search of wisdom and attaining transcendental wisdom, and then he played out the pattern of restarting the Mayan civilization at Chichen Itza in 987, and then in 999 he disappeared in the eastern, sailing away, as they say, on a raft of serpents in the eastern ocean, sailing toward the east, saying that he would return on the day sacred to him in the year sacred to him. Well, two aspects of that. One was that when Cortez arrived in Mexico, it was exactly the day sacred to Quetzalcoatl and a year sacred to Quetzalcoatl. That is to say, a one-read day in a one-read year. And so that was very prophetic and had to do with a deeper prophecy. The deeper prophecy about Quetzalcoatl came to me through Tony Shearer, a Lakota journalist and poet and kind of a maverick guy, very interesting man. I met him in 1969. I had already been in pursuit of the mystery of Quetzalcoatl, and he was writing a book called Lord of the Dawn about Quetzalcoatl, and he introduced me to the prophecy of the 13 heavens and the 9 hells, which refer to 52-year cycles. 13 52-year cycles that came to an end in 1519 when Cortez landed in Mexico on the day sacred to Quetzalcoatl and the year sacred to Quetzalcoatl, and 9 hell cycles, which would, the 9th hell cycle, which was to end on August 16th, 1987. So I was introduced to that day through Tony, and that really, that was another one of those, for me, wake-up calls. I knew that that was part of my mission. I was supposed to have that date, and I was supposed to do something on that date to commemorate Quetzalcoatl and the prophecy of Quetzalcoatl. So I've been feeling for a long time many different things, many aspects of this Quetzalcoatl, and I felt if nothing else, it must be one of my guides. And who also was guiding Tony, and I felt that Tony and I were definitely guided to come together. And we met a number of times in the early 70s, and he shared with me all that he knew about the ancient calendar, the 260-day calendar. He introduced to me the form of that calendar as a type of magic square, a matrix of 13 by 20 units, mathematical matrix. And he also introduced me to the idea of Pakalvotan. And through his discussions I had with Tony and studies of the calendar, sometime in the early 70s, I arrived at the conclusion that the great cycle of the Maya that was being measured in all the monuments, that this great cycle was going to come to an end in 2012. I put that in my book, Transformative Vision, in 1975. And I also knew that between 1987 and 2012 was going to be a period of tremendous transformation on this planet. In the 1980s, when I knew I had to do something about that August 16th date, I realized that there was something called the harmonic convergence. That phrase came to me in 1984. When I was thinking about it, and then set to work on notifying as many people as I could about this, that we had to go to sacred places and commemorate the closing of this particular prophetic cycle, and then open the gates to the final 25 years to 2012. So, and all of that was fulfillment of the prophecy of Quetzalcoatl.
Very, very interesting. You once invited Thomas Banyaka to deliver the Hopi prophecy to your students at Evergreen. First of all, tell us how he arrived. I mean, what did he have with him when he arrived?
Well, that was great. He arrived, it was in December, I think, of 1972. He arrived with his small entourage of Hopi, and I was very impressed because we were in this kind of, we're at Evergreen State College in Washington, which was a new school, but it was all concrete. And we were in this, it's kind of like this huge concrete bunker, and he was there with his entourage of Hopi, and he spread out this large piece of cloth that had the same pictograms that you have a prophecy rock. He put them onto this piece of cloth so he could explain the Hopi prophecy. It was very, very impressive, and he showed how the two shakings of the gourd of ashes, which were the two atomic bombs that had been dropped, and the two world wars, excuse me, the shaking of the gourd of ashes. And then he said that there would be a third shaking, and that he showed at the far end of that how there were two roads. One road went up, and then it kind of like broke apart and then fell down when there was this third shaking of the gourd of ashes. And then the other road, which is the red road, the one road that went up is the black road, the one down below is the red road. And that at the end, at the end of the red road, after the black road rises to the sky and then falls apart, that the red road would remain. And that was the road of the Hopi, the road of the people of peace, the road of the people of truth. And then as he was speaking, as they arrived, it had been snowing. And as he was speaking, the snow became very intense. It was clearly a blizzard. And before he was done speaking, all the power had gone out. And he got quite a kick out of that, because that kind of like punctuated the prophecy. And he said that was precisely the point. This is what we had to prepare for, that the civilization would collapse or fail. And then he said something that stayed with me the rest of my life: only a people who are spiritually strong will survive. And that was about as good a presentation of the Hopi prophecy as I think you could get.
Very auspicious, almost like the lightning strike that started tonight's broadcast.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Now there's something called the Blue Star Kachina. Isn't that, that's kind of synergistic with the Hopi prophecy,
yeah,
too,
that's
right?
Yeah, part of the Hopi prophecy, too, and they said when the Blue Star Kachina shows up, you know, that that's supposed to happen in 2012, that then that will be the end, that will be the beginning of the passage into the fifth world. That would mean the fourth world is definitively over, and that's as you know, they have the we're in the fourth world, or the fourth world is now ending. Incidentally, I met Thomas Bagnacca again in 1995 or 96. I went to Hopi Mesa to see him. We had a brief but very sweet meeting, and at that time he said, well, he'd been to the House of Micah, as they call it, the UN, the United Nations, a few times, and he said that, you know, to deliver the prophecy there, but obviously no one was really heeding it. And he said, well, you know, it's really now in the hands of the people. And that no, in other words, that no institution, no government, no larger organization like that is going to be able to save us. The people have to save themselves.
Yeah, I see that. There's another small indigenous group called the Kogi. Are you familiar with them?
Yeah, down in Colombia. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think they issued a prophecy that said, I think they had gone into a trance-like state, and issued a prophecy that in 1999 the technological world was going to come to an end. And they woke up the day after this prophetic date in 1999, and of course the technological world did not end. And so they went back into their trance-like state to find out why. I mean, did they make a mistake? You know, was there some kind of error? And the answer came back, there was no error, but there were points of light all over the planet, little points of light where people had awakened and had affected the universe in their local area and had changed the future. And thus, uh-huh, the 1999 collapse did not happen.
Yeah, so the Y2K didn't occur.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, many people ask me, and there's another new 2012 book coming out every single day, and my co-author and I wrote three books on 2012 from a scientific and archaeological point of view, not a prophetic point of view. And more people are beginning to look up from their worldly works and wonder the same thing. What can you tell us about the Hopi, the Kachina, and the Votan prophecies? What is going to happen in 2012?
Well, it's clear that we are at the closing of a cycle, that we have, on the one hand, we have, in the last 200 years, that the human species has exponentially expanded itself around the Earth. There were 500 million humans in 1750. That number had grown only very slowly over the previous 5,000 years, from 300 million to 500 million, just to give you some scale. But then, with the beginning of the Industrial Age and the full entry into artificial time, the population began to increase exponentially. From 500 million, it doubled in 90 years to a billion in 1840. It doubled again in another 90 years to 1930 to 2 billion. And then from that point, it's been escalating. We're now going on 7 billion in a very, very brief time. And our machines have expanded and moved and propagated even faster than we have. So we're in a race to keep up with our machines, but we keep making machines that go way faster than us. So we're all accelerating, going at a very rapid rate. We're just about at the point where we can't go any faster. It's all going to just like come to a halt, come to an end. And I think that's the main thing there, that from the Mayan point of view, that the we're passing through a great beam that's been, you might say, 5,125 years in diameter, and that beam has had the effect of accelerating and creating a high process of change in the frequency of the human species to get it to this point where it is now fully a planetary organism. But the means of its getting there have become outmoded, and they've outlived their usefulness. We're creating more destruction than we are creating harmony. We're creating more toxic waste than we can clean up. So our destructive aspect has gotten ahead of us, as the Hopi prophecy says. You know, we have a right side that is clever and a left side that's wise and does things slowly, and the right side's clever and does things fast. Well, these have gotten out of phase, and so we're at that point where the whole process is going to come to a halt, just like the auspicious event of the snowstorm knocking out the electricity when Thomas was giving the Hopi prophecy. Probably in 2012, as NASA is now on record saying, a solar flare will probably knock out the electromagnetic grid of the planet. This is due to the fact that on June 3rd, 2007, that a solar wind of great intensity opened a breach in the electromagnetic field, deposited unprecedented amounts of plasma in the field, and when we have a solar flare of a great magnitude in 2012, it's predicted that it will hit the magnetic field, and all the plasmas that are stored in there in unprecedented numbers now will be released and have to the effect of knocking out the electromagnetic power grid. Something like this happened in the 1850s when there wasn't much of an electric power grid, but a big flare hit the field and all the telegraph lines went out. Well, we've got more than telegraph lines going out now. The whole civilization is absolutely dependent on this electronic grid. So that will be what we might refer to as the knockout punch. That's just nature's way of saying game's over. And the 2012 actually means that we're going into what you might refer to as a resonant frequency phase shift. That we're being restored into natural time. We're going into a higher frequency. This is a galactic ripple in a cosmic wave, and that there's just a shutter in the loom that goes all across the loom. There's a little adjustment that occurs, and we're operating a slightly higher frequency. We're going to be, you might also think of it as somewhat of a dimensional shift. There will be our fourth dimensional operating capacities will be activated, and we'll be entering a new evolutionary stage, which is referred to as the noosphere. The noosphere is the mental field that governs and supersedes the biological functionings of the unity called life. So that's in a somewhat generalized nutshell what we see happening in 2012 what this is about. So everything is quickening. This is in our DNA. That's why everybody's writing a book on 2012. It's like
it's turning on.
Yeah, it's like everyone says it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. You know, and the fact that everyone says it's coming, you know, from a certain point of view, it's already happened in a future time wave. And all these books and everything that are coming closer and closer to 2012 is just like we're feeling as we approach that event horizon. We're like in quantum physics, that's already happened. Okay. So
yeah,
all these books and everything are just saying, wow, look at this. This is just kind of like the splash. All the 2012 drops that are landing in the present moment.
It isn't that we're manifesting it with the books and the consciousness. It's that we're remembering the future.
Yeah, we're remembering the future, exactly. That's exactly what is going on the closer we get to it. Because I brought this, you know, I met Terrence McKenna in the 1980s there, and we talked about this. He'd, you know, of course, he had brought up the 2012 thing and his invisible landscape, which he did in 1978 or 79, and I was already working on this as well. And we both, you know, he came through it through his particular way, and I was coming through it through the Mayan calendar, but we both agreed, well, that's going to be it. That's the big one. And you know, when I put that out, when it in the Mayan factor in 1987, that was the whole point of that book, and the whole point of the harmonic convergence was saying, look, this is all we're doing is opening the gate to 2012, and if you know it's coming, you better get ready. But most people don't believe that, and so for a lot of people it might be kind of shocking. But on the other hand, we still have a little bit of time. We've still got 1,341-42 days, you know, till December 21st, 2012. So there's a lot can happen in 1,342 days. So
that's our rate of technological advancement. But, you know, we realize that we never actually really die. I mean, there's some fear about death in our generation, but not, and it always hasn't been so. And the afterlife has been a transition period between, you know, mortalities or 3D existences, but we always exist. There is, however, a rare and magnificent opportunity, I think, to be alive while the planet Earth goes through this phase in her evolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think this will only affect this world, or do you think there are implications for the whole universe here?
Well, it seems to be that it's an across the board shift. Okay, that the sun, you know, we're basically operating in the heliosphere, which is the sphere, the solar sphere. The planets are functions of the heliosphere. The orbits of the planets hold the harmonic resonances of the big Om that the sun is always emitting, and the sun is receiving instructions from other parts of the galaxy. You know, we're in a local galaxy cluster, and we're part of the Virgo supercluster. And then the Virgo supercluster is connected, like, to the central core. And then and then our galaxy, you know, it's all like these holes within holes. So the whole process of cosmic evolution is just ongoing. And there's always these shifts that are occurring. And, you know, we'll be experiencing something. We'll be going from being humans to superhumans, you know. We'll be operating with telepathy and all of our paranormal powers intact, and we won't need all this technology. And then in other parts of the universe, there's other beings that are going to be going from super to suprahuman, from mind to beyond mind. So there's all these different possibilities that are happening, but it all moves through in like a giant symphony that's going through another chord change.
And the fact that the note is going to change here at planet Earth makes all the paranormalisms, this makes it center stage. So maybe it's not just humans that live here that are interested in that change.
Yeah.
Jose, we have a caller on line two. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from. Caller, are you there? Oh, she was hanging on and... Oh, there she is.
Hi.
Are you there? Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth from Virginia Beach. How you doing?
Great, fantastic. Welcome.
Yeah, I can hear you, Elizabeth.
Okay, great. I just caught the last end of what you said because I'm in another room and then they clicked me on. This wasn't my question, but I just wanted to say I heard you say something about the sun picking up its instructions from other parts of the galaxy and everything, and I also, from my understanding, the sun also picks up on our individual as well as collective frequencies and responds to that as to what it puts back toward us individually as well as a collective, and then what it puts out everywhere else. Is that your understanding also?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're all basically cosmic tuning forks, and and so, you know, we have, as we say, the individual ones, then we form a collective that's the planetary whole, and then the planetary is connected to the solar, and then the solar
that's
to the...
That's lovely, isn't it?
Like that, okay? So it's all part of a big harmonic resonant show.
Well, the real question is, are we the resonant tuning fork, or are we striking ourselves and making the vibration?
I think both.
Yeah, all of the above.
Yeah. my question actually was when the kill shot happens, because that's when I left the room. if your electric items are not plugged in, do they still get negatively affected? Or after that shift has finished doing its wave of frequency, and you replug them in, would they, like, say if you had something plugged into a wind turbine or something like that, do you think that it would still work? I think that the
solar and the wind technologies those are natural, operating in natural frequency, those will be adjusted.
Oh, okay. So if they're plugged in when the kill shot happens, you think they'll be adjusted and it will be okay?
I think that may be possible. They might be knocked off a little bit, but it won't be like the big power grid.
Okay.
I think that's a very important point. I think that's why people should really, really, really be investing in solar and be putting it out, or wind technologies, and really, really be getting those going. Because anything that's on a natural, non-polluting basis is going to survive the process, and we'll be able to be plugged in maybe with a minor adjustment or two.
Right, and don't forget to pick up your electric car from Global Green Cars, because they'll be too. Wow, I love this, because we get calls in and it directs the show and just higher and higher levels. Elizabeth, you know, how do you feel that the... You know, the Earth is getting ready to go through this evolutionary change. Certainly the beings upon her were in greater concentration than we've ever been before, and who knows if we're all even from here. Do you think that the Earth going through this is going to just affect this neighborhood, or do you think the whole universe is about to shift because of what we're about to do?
Oh, I think every multiverse is going to shift. I've been looking at this stuff since I was a kid in my head before I had words to explain anything. So all of it's very familiar to me. It's lovely and sad at the same time to see people pick up all the aspects, and some people get stuck in the parts that look scary, and other people flourish and pay attention to the parts that look lovely, which is ideally where they would focus, or any of us would focus. But... Really, I mean, for myself, I've always felt like every single part of everything is connected. And I felt like we've kind of been doing this, I don't know, I always felt like we did this numerous times, because everything always felt so familiar and recognizable, not just like a deja vu.
Yeah.
I've always felt like almost like if we are everything, then we've already been through every single stage. And this has been my... personal comprehension, not from reading anything. But if we're part of everything, and we've always seen every aspect on at least our whole persona of everything, and participated in every aspect, then we would be able to pinpoint where the most susceptible place for the rest of everything else to register itself as self would be. And in my opinion, from my personal experiences and things that I've seen, it kind of come down to this seems to be one of those pinpointed places within all of experience that kind of opens everything up into registering itself. That includes past, present, future, all of it. Somehow it has one of those key points from everything else that we've looked through. Could be wrong, but that's just kind of how I feel.
That sounds like a very enlightened point of view.
Thank you. I would say so too, given I imagine the extent of your library, but I think you probably came to this general concept long before you became a wide reader. So I think you've plugged into some kind of download that's given you this pure knowledge, and now you're coming to an understanding of that knowledge.
Yeah. Well, I was an only child, and I talked to myself a lot, and there wasn't really anybody else to ask, so I'd ask myself, and, you know.
Well, that's fine when you're the only intelligent person around to talk to. You know, Jose wrote a book called Transformative Vision, and I'm just going to read a short quote in here and get your opinion on it. It says, in order for us to transcend the combative dualism that is the very essence of our condition, there must be a unitive experience of the world that can be achieved only through a major collective catharsis. Now, you know, catharsis is kind of a great emotional breakdown spiritual humbling. What do you think of that?
I think that's what we're doing. I think
that's what we're undergoing planetarily.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate for those only because of the emotions that they feel, not because it's not healthy for them and good for them to grow, but, you know, as an empath, you feel for them either way.
I look at the economic force that has been driving the, shall we call it, the capitalist militaristic empire view. And just in the last few months, I've seen some major collapse from it. I mean, look at Madoff goes to jail and another person openly and blatantly engaging in naked shorts, just destroying small companies as they try to bring about alternative energies, throws himself in front of a train because he goes from being a billionaire taking advantage of these companies to being a pauper. You know, I think that maybe this catharsis is occurring right before our eyes.
It is. I completely agree with you. And the thing is that nothing's negative and nothing's positive. It's all just as it is. And every part that appears negative always has a positive end result, even if it looks ugly on end to those of us who are looking from a 3D perspective. On a whole perspective, it always has its purpose to route those and the rest of us into being the best version of ourselves that we can possibly be.
Jose, in one of your books, you depict the Ouroboros, which is a dragon that's turning around, biting his own tail. What is the significance of the Ouroboros with 2012, and what do you think it means for modern society?
Yeah, well, that's the Ouroboros that bites his tail. That's the circle of unity coming to itself, and that's the meaning of 2012. That we're right at this point now, where the serpent is biting his tail, and the alchemical tradition. It says when the serpent bites its tail, it releases the poison that heals itself. And so right now we see that there's many poisons that are being released on the planet, and that's a function of this coming to the end of the serpent attaining union with itself, biting its tail. But through that, then the serpent, the world, becomes healed. So that this is like you go up, take this up a few notches up there, and you see, oh, this is like we're like the fever is breaking. You know, we're the patient down here, and the fever is breaking, and that when we wake up, coming out of this intense fevered state, where we've created this big, whatever it is that we got here, this crisis, as it's called, on this planet that when a fever breaks and we wake up from it, we'll find that we're healed, that we're a whole organism, that the planet is actually okay, that we're going to make it. But we have to go through this, and we have to shed this skin as well, so we can get to the other side in a new evolutionary condition, as a new whole being, as a planetary organism on a healed planet.
Now, Elizabeth, do you think that has to be post-technological, or do you think there's a place for technology in this new evolution?
I think in the beginning that people are still going to utilize some ports and some parts of technology as they're starting to understand their own personal abilities more. But the more they understand them, the less they need them, and the more they realize they really don't need any of these things because everything's always available 100% of the time. That's part of, from my personal understanding, fifth dimensional space or that five vibration of frequency is manifestation and demanifestation. So if you're in that space on a whole space, you don't have anything destructive in you. So you're always there, whereas if you have something destructive, you obviously transport yourself elsewhere immediately by the nature of it. But in that space, you have the ability to have anything that is serving at will and have it also not be there, so there's no waste either. It just takes people imagination and time to register that part, in my opinion. But I wanted to just say real quick, before I forget, that part where you said the poison, I thought was wonderful. And I just want to remind anyone that's listening that often a lot of poisons are actually medicines. That includes animal bites and like bee stings and ant bites and things along those lines. Sometimes snake bites even. Some of their venom and things are used for healing. So I just want to throw that out to go along with the thing that not everything that looks negative is as negative as it seems.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
And my boyfriend had wanted me to say something about 2012, and just to remind everyone that we're not on, sorry, I'm back clock. We're not on the same schedule as what they have written, so the timing might be off, and not to think of it as a, you know, detonating date of some sort, like, unfortunately.
That's right. It might happen this next Friday, so you might as well start preparing now.
But it's all good, you know. Everybody's going to be exactly where they need to be at that given time, whenever it happens to be. And the best thing you can do is throw out love and faith that everything's good.
Very good message. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for letting me talk. I really appreciate it. I mean, I can stay on, but but in case anybody else wants to call.
Okay. You can stay on. I don't have another line filled. You can stay with us till we finish in 15 minutes. Jose, you also mentioned the use of the Tzolk'in, which I understand it to be the wheels of time, untime, and who knows how ancient they are. The mathematical patterns that the Maya understood and employed, not only in their calendar system, but in their language, and, you know, this is the precision with which the future was predicted by the Mayans, and they did it so consistently, down to the day and almost the hour. Someone asked me one time, well, you know, do you think 2012 is going to happen? Do you think anything's going to happen in 2012, or is it going to be like Y2K? And I guess I'll put the same question to you and not tell you my answer yet.
Well, you know, first of all, getting back to, like, saying, like, the knowledge of time and the precise timing of things. Yes, that's very true. That what I found is that what we refer to as the Tzolk'in is as a 1320 matrix, a matrix of 13 by 20 units. The numbers 1 to 13 repeated 20 times at the most mundane level. That I found that this actually is a fourth dimensional resonant matrix, and that it's in fractal in nature, and so it can be expanded to greater and greater numbers of possibilities. The 260, at its smallest, it's operating as a 260-day cycle. But for instance, what's called the long count, which is the cycle that ends on December 21st, 2012, which is what all the big fuss is about, that long count, that actually represents, is also a 1320 matrix. It starts at August 13th, 3113 to December 21st, 2012. That's 1,872,000 days, or 13 subcycles of 144,000 days each, and each of those 13 subcycles is divided into a further 20 subcycles called katoons. So you have the same 1320 matrix, 13 baktoons, 20 katoons, which is a fractal of the 260-day cycle of 13 cycles, 20 cycles of 13 days, or 13 cycles of 20 days. So that fractal property, which is a higher dimensional property, and then you can take that higher and higher, or make larger and larger measurements and so on. All that's reduced into that fractal measure, which is a fourth dimensional, resonant matrix. And that, well, to operate it at the higher and higher dimensional levels means that you're operating at a higher dimensional or supermental state of mind. And a supermental or superconscious state of mind operating with these matrices, and you're operating in a higher dimension, you actually can see the different, as you can see from that vista, the different cycles of time, their beginnings and their endings. And you also know when to apply certain measures to correspond to certain stages of evolutionary function, so that you know exactly when that function reaches its particular stage. Here, as I said, we're dealing with cosmic level of civilization that has produced and left this particular knowledge, the 1320 knowledge, and that psychic, at the level that cosmic civilization is operating, there's an understanding of the different stages of cosmic evolution that we are only very, very, very dimly aware of from where we are. And from that knowledge of the stages of cosmic evolution and the cycles of time, they're able to say, okay, this phase of evolution on this particular planet has this much time to go through, and when it gets to this point, it's going to hit this kind of peak, and it's going to feel like it's hitting a wall, but it's just coming to a particular shift. And when that shift occurs, then it will phase into another state of the cosmic evolution. As I was saying earlier, when I first put out that 2012 date in the Mayan factor in 1987, and it went into the mainstream consciousness, I didn't know what would happen when we got to 2012, but now I see that as we've gotten to this point in 2012, that there's literally hundreds, if not thousands, of books about it. And so this demonstrates that we're getting to this event horizon that's already, as the Mayans knew, the galactic minds, it was already part of our program. We understand it by this date, 2012, and so that's how it comes out. But in actuality, that's just because that corresponds to a cultural moment in our time, and in actuality, that's how we are experiencing this inevitable cosmic ripple.
Well, I know that really we're experiencing it, and we're aware of it. Elizabeth's aware of it, but you know, all you have to do is turn on the evening news and see that there are at least very visible factions of humanity that are not aware of it. And so, what's going to happen to them as we go through 2012?
As I said, we have 1,342 days, and I'm sure that by the time you're down to 100 days, that everybody's going to be aware of it.
Yeah.
I like it. That's a good answer. What do you think, Elizabeth?
Because it's already going so, that's what I'm saying, it's already going so exponentially
mm-hmm.
that it's going to be like suddenly the whole board is filled up with 2012 announcements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you think the third shaking of the gourd of ashes is going to occur?
Well, in some limited form, I think something like that might happen by late 2011, early 2012. And that might be the final touch. But I just don't know.
Now, I wonder if those people who are more aware and who have been, let's say, visualizing or imaging in what it is that they would like their future world as a whole to be more like. If for them, their 2012 experience is going to be this lovely shift of a brightening of everything, and everything feels lighter and more free, and those people that are not aware and that are more closed off are going to naturally go into more of devastation where everything's more destructive and everything's crumbling around them. So much that, like, it's kind of like the split shift, but those of us as humans that are not so here consciously kind of continue on their everyday life, but everything gets harder and harder, whereas those of us who are more aware continue on our everyday life, and everything just gets more light and bright and easier and loving without that interconnection. Kind of like how at the end of the Celestine Prophecy, where they give the example, which I thought was a nice example, they gave where when they've gotten to that cognitive space, they can still see everything around them, but those that were on a lower frequency didn't register that they were in front of them.
Ah, so you're talking about the grand separation, the separation of the union of the polarities.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I've always seen it, so I don't know if anybody else sees it that way.
So the higher dimensional Earth will go through its whatever veil.
Well, you know, the main scenario there that also plays out for that aspect of it is that those that are not able to learn, that they will be taken to places where they can learn.
Right. Yeah.
That we'll have, at that point, those of us who, those of the humanity that show that they're learning and that they're understanding that this is a big wake-up call, that what we're looking at is the rapid evolution of a mass awakening in the next 3 years, that those who can answer that call will have demonstrated that they can get out of the box and take responsibility for their own life and for their own spiritual evolution, and that they will, by that time, create a critical mass such that the higher dimensional entities that have been supervising and monitoring and watching this show, that they will then respond to the critical mass that has been experiencing the mass awakening, and they will make themselves known in such a way that it'll be very clear that we are not alone, and that those who have understood and taken responsibility for their spiritual evolution will be they'll be acknowledged, and they'll be have the capacity to inherit the new earth that emerges from this. And those that who are incapable of learning, then they will be gently taken to other places that are appropriate to their levels of understanding, and they'll continue their evolutionary processes there. It's a big universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And there's that in between time, like right at that edge, as things are shifting, where some of us that have an awareness that can kind of flip back and forth between our registries and being around those who aren't, kind of like in that in-between as it's shifting time, to people that, like you were saying, that are almost there, but just like right at that edge, and communicate with them in such a way that they actually register and open themselves up.
That's
really why the three of us are here, because our understanding is that the cycle of our mortalities and the cycle of the Earth's transition have now coincided, which gives us the privilege of being teachers at this critical transitional point. And I think collectively we are expressing our gratitude at being given that privilege, and we shouldn't
and
pass it up, right?
Reminders, because everybody knows everything. We're born knowing it all. It's all part of us. We just have to remember it. Just got to remember it.
That's a great word. Remember the future.
Because if you think about remember it, it's, you know, becoming back one with something. Is how I always thought of it.
Right. Elizabeth, you've been part of a magnificent show.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a very lovely show. Thank you so much for speaking. And I appreciate it every week.
Thank you.
I really enjoy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Don't hesitate to call back in another time.
Okay, thank you. You all have a wonderful night. God bless.
Good night. Have a great week. Jose, I'm always in amazement at this program, how 3 hours can go by in 25 minutes, but it does.
It does. It's just a blink of the eye.
I've had a marvelous time. The book is called 2012, Biography of a Time Traveler by Stephanie South, who is your biographer. Where can our listeners get the book? Everywhere?
Everywhere. Borders, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Wow. I'm grateful that you came on tonight. I've had a marvelous time, and I'll never forget it.
Yeah, great. Well, I appreciate the opportunity, about that book, the way Stephanie has written that, it's a genuinely interactively transformative tale, and I think that it will be very good preparation for 2012.
And there's another volume of this coming out, as I mentioned to Stephanie when she came on and introduced you. I get the feeling, and I've read the book twice now, it's pretty tattered, that there was more to this book, another 200 pages anyway, and she said there's another volume coming out. So we'll keep you on the menu when that comes out.
Great. Okay, well, thanks again for the opportunity, and keep sharing your visions and keep moving things along.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful week.
Okay, you too. Good night, and God bless you. Bye-bye.
Good night, and God bless you. All right, there you have it, Earth Explorers. April 19th, my oldest daughter's birthday. Happy birthday, April. I think, let's see. That's okay. We will end now. So thank you so much, and we will see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, Peace, Earth Explorers.